This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Winter of the World by Ken Follett. Read by John Lee. Chapter 16. 1943. Part 2. Colonel Albert Beck got a Russian bullet in his right lung at Kharkov in March 1943. He was lucky. A field surgeon put in a chest drain and reinflated the lung, saving his life. Just. Weakened by blood loss and the almost inevitable infection, Beck was put on a train home and ended up in Karl's Hospital in Berlin. He was a tough, wiry man in his early 40s, prematurely bald, with a protruding jaw like the prow of a Viking longboat. The first time he spoke to Carla, he was drugged and feverish and wildly indiscreet. "We're losing the war," he said. She was immediately alert. A discontented officer was a potential source of information. She said, lightly, "The newspapers say we're shortening the line on the Eastern Front." He laughed scornfully. "That means we're retreating." She continued to draw him out. "And Italy looks bad." The Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, Hitler's greatest ally, had fallen.
"Remember 1939? And 1940?
Beck said nostalgically.
"One brilliant lightning victory after another. Those were the days."
Clearly he was not ideological, perhaps not even political. He was a normal patriotic soldier who had stopped kidding himself. Carla led him on.
"It can't be true that the army is short of everything from bullets to underpants."
This kind of mildly risky talk was not unusual in Berlin nowadays.
"Of course we are."
Beck was radically disinhibited, but quite articulate.
"Germany simply can't produce as many guns and tanks as the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States combined. Especially when we're being bombed constantly. And no matter how many Russians we kill, the Red Army seems to have an inexhaustible supply of new recruits."
"What do you think will happen?"
"The Nazis will never admit defeat, of course. So more people will die. Millions more. Just because they're too proud to yield. Insanity. Insanity."
He drifted off to sleep. You had to be sick or crazy to voice such thoughts, but Carla believed that more and more people were thinking that way. Despite relentless government propaganda, it was becoming clear that Hitler was losing the war. There had been no police investigation of the death of Joachim Koch. It had been reported in the newspaper as a road accident. Carla had got over the initial shock, but every now and again the realization hit her that she had killed a man, and she would relive his death in her imagination. It made her shake, and she had to sit down. This had happened only once when she was on duty, fortunately, and she had passed that off as a faint due to hunger, highly plausible in wartime Berlin. Her mother was worse. It was strange that Maud had loved Joachim, weak and foolish as he was, but there was no explaining love. Carla herself had completely misjudged Werner Frank, thinking he was strong and brave, only to learn that he was selfish and weak. She talked to Beck a lot before he was discharged, probing to find out what kind of man he was. Once recovered, he never again spoke indiscreetly about the war. She learned that he was a career soldier. His wife was dead, and his married daughter lived in Buenos Aires. His father had been a Berlin city councillor. He did not say for which party, so clearly it was not the Nazis or any of their allies. He never said anything bad about Hitler, but he never said anything good either, nor did he speak disparagingly of Jews or communists. These days that in itself was close to insubordination. His lung would heal, but he would never again be strong enough for active service, and he told her he was being posted to the general staff. He could become a diamond mine of vital secrets. She would be risking her life if she tried to recruit him, but she had to try. She knew he would not remember their first conversation.
"You were very candid," Carla told him in a low voice.
There was no one nearby.
"You said we were losing the war."
His eyes flashed fear. He was no longer a woozy patient in a hospital gown with stubble on his cheeks. He was washed and shaved, sitting upright in dark blue pajamas buttoned to the throat.
"I suppose you're going to report me to the Gestapo," he said. "I don't think a man should be held to account for what he says when he's sick and raving.
You weren't raving, she said. You were very clear. But I'm not going to report you to anyone.
No?
Because you are right.
He was surprised.
Now I should report you.
If you do, I'll say that you insulted Hitler in your delirium, and when I threatened to report it, you made up a story about me in self-defense.
If I denounce you, you'll denounce me, he said.
Stalemate. But you're not going to denounce me, she said.
I know that,
because I know you. I've nursed you.
You're a good man. You joined the army for love of your country, but you hate the war and you hate the Nazis.
She was 99% sure of this.
It's very dangerous to talk like that.
I know.
So this isn't just a casual conversation.
Correct.
You said that millions of people are going to die just because the Nazis are too proud to surrender.
Did I?
You can help save some of those millions.
How?
Carla paused. This was where she put her life on the line.
Any information you have, I can pass it to the appropriate quarters.
She held her breath. If she was wrong about Beck, she was dead. She read amazement in his look. He could hardly imagine that this briskly efficient young nurse was a spy. But he believed her. She could see that.
He said, I think I understand you.
She handed him a green hospital file folder empty. He took it.
What's this for?
He said.
You're a soldier. You understand camouflage.
He nodded.
You're risking your life, he said,
and she saw something like admiration in his eyes.
So are you, now?
Yes,
said Colonel Beck,
but I'm used to it.
2. Early in the morning, Thomas Marker took young Werner Frank to the Plötzensee prison in the western suburb of Charlottenburg.
You should see this, he said. Then you can tell General Dorn how effective we are.
He parked in the Königsdamm and led Werner to the rear of the main prison. They entered a room 25 feet long and about half as wide. Waiting there was a man dressed in a tailcoat, a top hat, and white gloves. Werner frowned at the peculiar costume.
This is Herr Reichardt, said Marker, the executioner.
Werner swallowed.
So, we're going to witness an execution?
Yes.
With a casual air that might have been faked, Werner said,
why the fancy dress outfit?
Marker shrugged.
Tradition.
A black curtain divided the room in two. Marker drew it back to show 8 hooks attached to an iron girder that ran across the ceiling. Werner said,
for hanging?
Marker nodded. There was also a wooden table with straps for holding someone down. At one end of the table was a high device of distinctive shape. On the floor was a heavy basket. The young lieutenant was pale.
A guillotine, he said.
Exactly,
said Marker. He looked at his watch.
We shan't be kept waiting long.
More men filed into the room. Several nodded in a familiar way to Marker. Speaking quietly into Werner's ear, Marker said,
regulations demand that the judges, the court officers, the prison governor, and the chaplain all attend.
Werner swallowed. He was not liking this, Marker could see. He was not meant to. Marker's motive in bringing him here had nothing to do with impressing General Dorn. Marker was worried about Werner. There was something about him that did not ring true. Werner worked for Dorn. That was not in question. He had accompanied Dorn on a visit to Gestapo headquarters, and subsequently Dorn had written a note saying that the Berlin counter-espionage effort was most impressive, and mentioning Marker by name. For weeks afterward, Marker had walked around in a miasma of warm pride. But Marker could not forget Werner's behavior on that evening, nearly a year ago now, when they had almost caught a spy in a disused fur coat factory near the East Station. Werner had panicked, or had he? Accidentally or otherwise, he had given the pianist enough warning to get away. Marker could not shake the suspicion that the panic had been an act, and Werner had in fact been coolly and deliberately sounding the alarm. Marker did not quite have the nerve to arrest and torture Werner. It could be done, of course, but Dorn might well kick up a fuss, and then Marker would be questioned. His boss, Superintendent Kringelein, who did not much like him, would ask what hard evidence he had against Werner, and he had none. But this ought to reveal the truth. The door opened again, and two prison guards entered either side of a young woman called Lily Markgraf. He heard Werner gasp.
"What's the matter?" Marker said.
Werner said, "You didn't tell me it was going to be a girl."
"Do you know her?"
"No." Lily was 22, Marker knew, though she looked younger. Her fair hair had been cut this morning, and it was now as short as a man's. She was limping, and walked bent over as if she had an abdominal injury. She wore a plain blue dress of heavy cotton with no collar, just a round neckline. Her eyes were red with crying. The guards held her arms firmly, not taking any chances.
"This woman was denounced by a relative who found the code book hidden in her room," Marka said. "The 5-digit Russian code."
"Why is she walking like that?"
"The effects of interrogation. But we didn't get anything from her."
Werner's face was impassive. "What a shame," he said. "She might have led us to other spies." Marka saw no sign that he was faking.
"She knew her associate only as Heinrich, no last name, and he may have used a pseudonym anyway. I find we rarely profit by arresting women. They don't know enough. But at least you have her code book, for what it's worth. They change the keyword regularly, so we still face a challenge in decrypting their signals. Pity."
One of the men cleared his throat and spoke loudly enough for everyone to hear. He said he was the president of the court, then read out the death sentence. The guards walked Lily to the wooden table. They gave her the chance of lying on it voluntarily, but she took a step backward, so they picked her up forcibly. She did not struggle. They laid her face down and strapped her in. The chaplain began a prayer. Lily began to plead.
"No, no,"
she said, without raising her voice.
"No, please, let me go. Let me go."
She spoke coherently, as if she were merely asking someone for a favor. The man in the top hat looked at the president, who shook his head and said, "Not yet. The prayer must be finished." Lily's voice rose in pitch and urgency.
"I don't want to die. I'm afraid to die. Don't do this to me, please."
The executioner looked again at the court president. This time the president just ignored him. Marker studied Werner. He looked sick, but so did everybody else in the room. As a test, this was not really working. Werner's reaction showed that he was sensitive, not that he was a traitor. Marker might have to think of something else. Lily began to scream. Even Marker felt impatient. The pastor hurried through the rest of the prayer. When he said, "Amen," she stopped screaming, as if she knew it was all over. The president gave the nod. The executioner moved a lever, and the weighted blade fell. It made a whispering sound as it sliced through Lily's pale neck. Her short cropped head fell forward, and there was a gush of blood. The head hit the basket with a loud thump that seemed to resound in the room. Absurdly, Marco wondered if the head felt any pain. 3. Carla bumped into Colonel Beck in the hospital corridor. He was in uniform. She looked at him in sudden fear. Ever since he was discharged, she had lived every day in fear that he had betrayed her, and the Gestapo were on their way. But he smiled and said, "I came back for a checkup with Dr. Ernst." Was that all? Had he forgotten their conversation? Was he pretending to have forgotten it? Was there a black Gestapo Mercedes waiting outside? Beck was carrying a green hospital file folder. A cancer specialist in a white coat approached. As he went by, Carla said brightly to Beck,
"How are things?
I'm as fit as I'm ever going to be. I'll never lead a battalion into battle again, but aside from athletics, I can lead a normal life."
"I'm glad to hear that."
People kept walking by. Carla feared Beck would never get the chance to say anything to her privately, but he remained unruffled.
"I'd just like to thank you for your kindness and professionalism."
"You're welcome.
Goodbye, sister.
Goodbye, Colonel."
When Beck left, Carla was holding the file folder. She walked briskly to the nurse's cloakroom. It was empty. She stood with her heel firmly wedged against the door so no one could come in. Inside the folder was a large envelope made of the cheap, buff-colored paper used in offices everywhere. Carla opened the envelope. It contained several typewritten sheets. She looked at the first, without removing it from the envelope. It was headed, Operational Order Number 6, Code Citadel. It was the battle plan for the summer offensive on the Eastern Front. Her heart raced. This was gold dust. She had to pass the envelope to Frida. Unfortunately, Frida was not working at the hospital today. It was her day off. Carla considered leaving the hospital right away, in the middle of her shift, and going to Frida's house, but she swiftly rejected that idea. Better to behave normally, not to attract attention. She slipped the envelope into the shoulder bag hanging on her coat hook. She covered it with the blue and gold silk scarf that she always carried for hiding things. She stood still for a few moments, letting her breathing return to normal. Then she went back to the ward. She worked the rest of her shift as best she could. Then she put on her coat, left the hospital, and walked to the station. Passing a bomb site, she saw graffiti on the remains of the building. A defiant patriot had written, "Our walls might break, but not our hearts." But someone else had ironically quoted Hitler's 1933 election slogan, "Give me 4 years, and you will not recognize Germany." She bought a ticket to the zoo. On the train, she felt like an alien. All the other passengers were loyal Germans, and she was the one with secrets in her bag to betray to Moscow. She did not like the feeling. No one looked at her, but that only made her think they were all deliberately avoiding her eye. She could hardly wait to hand over the envelope to Frida. The zoo station was on the edge of the Tiergarten. The trees were dwarfed now by a huge flak tower. One of three in Berlin, this square concrete block was more than 100 feet high. At the corners of the roof were four giant 128mm anti-aircraft guns, weighing 25 tons each. The raw concrete was painted green in a hopelessly optimistic attempt to make the monstrosity less of an eyesore in the park. Ugly though it was, Berliners loved it. When the bombs were falling, its thunder reassured them that somebody was shooting back. Still in a state of high tension, Carla walked from the station to Frida's house. It was mid-afternoon, so the Frank parents would probably be out, Ludi at his factory and Monica seeing a friend, possibly Carla's mother. Werner's motorcycle was parked on the drive. The manservant opened the door. "Miss Frida is out, but she won't be long," he said. "She went to KDV to buy gloves. Mr. Werner is in bed with a heavy cold. I'll wait for Frida in her room, as usual." Carla took off her coat and went upstairs, still carrying her bag. In Frida's room, she kicked off her shoes and lay on the bed to read the battle plan for Operation Citadel. She was as stressed as an overwound clock, but she would feel better when she had given the purloined document to someone else. From the next room, she heard the sound of sobbing. She was surprised. That was Werner's room. Carla found it hard to imagine the suave playboy in tears. But the sound definitely came from a man, and he seemed to be trying and failing to suppress his grief. Against her will, Carla felt pity. She told herself that some feisty woman had thrown Werner over, probably for very good reasons, but she could not help responding to the real distress she was hearing. She got off the bed, put the battle plan back in her bag, and stepped outside. She listened at Werner's door. She could hear it even more clearly. She was too soft-hearted to ignore it. She opened the door and went in. Werner was sitting on the edge of the bed, head in hands. When he heard the door, he looked up, startled. His face was red with emotion and wet with tears. His tie was pulled down and his collar undone. He looked at Carla with misery in his eyes. He was bowled over, devastated, and too wretched to care who knew it. Carla could not pretend to be heartless.
"What is it?" she said. "I can't do this anymore," he said.
She closed the door behind her.
"What happened?" "They cut off Lily Markgraf's head, and I had to watch."
Carla stared open-mouthed.
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"She was 22. He took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his face.
"You're already in danger. But if I tell you this, it will be a lot worse."
Her mind was full of amazing surmises.
"I think I can guess. But tell me," she said.
He nodded. "You'll figure it out soon, anyway.
Lily helped Heinrich broadcast to Moscow. It's much quicker if someone reads you the code groups, and the faster you go, the less likely you are to be caught. But Lily's cousin stayed at the apartment for a few days and found her codebooks. Nazi bitch! His words confirmed her astonishing suspicions.
You know about the spying?
He looked at her with an ironic smile. I'm in charge of it.
Good God!
That's why I had to drop the whole business of the murdered children. Moscow ordered me to, and they were right. If I'd lost my job at the Air Ministry, I would have had no access to secret papers, nor to other people who could bring me secrets. She needed to sit down. She perched on the edge of the bed beside him.
Why didn't you tell me?
We work on the assumption that everyone talks under torture. Knowing nothing, you can't betray others. Poor Lily was tortured, but she only knew Volodya, who's back in Moscow now, and Heinrich, and she never knew Heinrich's second name or anything else about him. Carlo was chilled to the bone. Everyone talks under torture. Werner finished. I'm sorry I've told you, but after seeing me like this, you were on the point of guessing it all anyway.
So I've completely misjudged you.
Not your fault. I deliberately misled you.
I feel a fool just the same. I've despised you for 2 years.
All the while I was desperate to explain to you. She put her arm around him. He took her other hand and kissed it.
Can you forgive me?
She was not sure how she felt, but she did not want to reject him when he was so down. So she said,
Yes, of course.
Poor Lily, he said. His voice fell to a whisper.
She had been so badly beaten. She could hardly walk to the guillotine. Yet she begged for life, right up to the end.
How come you were there?
I've befriended a Gestapo man, Inspector Thomas Marker. He took me.
Marker?
I remember him. He arrested my father.
She vividly recalled a round-faced man with a small black mustache, and she experienced again her rage at the arrogant power Marker had to take her father away, and her grief when he died of the injuries he suffered at Marker's hands.
I think he suspects me, and taking me to the execution was a test. Perhaps he thought I might lose my self-control and try to intervene. Anyway, I think I passed the test. But if you were arrested?
Werner nodded. Everyone talks under torture.
And you know everything?
Every agent, every code. The only thing I don't know is where they broadcast from. I leave it up to them to pick the locations, and they don't tell me. They held hands in silence. After a while, Carla said,
I came to give it to Frida, but I might as well give it to you.
Give what?
The battle plan for Operation Citadel.
Werner was electrified.
But I've been trying to put my hands on that for weeks. Where did you get it?
From an officer on the general staff?
Perhaps I shouldn't say his name.
Quite right. Don't tell me.
But is it authentic? You'd better take a look.
She went to Frida's room and returned with the buff envelope. It had never occurred to her that the document might not be genuine.
It looks all right to me, but what do I know?
He took out the typewritten sheets. After a minute he said,
This is the real thing. Fantastic.
I'm so glad. He stood up. I have to take this to Heinrich right away. We must get this encrypted and broadcast tonight. Carla felt disappointed that their moment of intimacy was over so soon, though she could not have said what she had been expecting. She followed him through the door. She picked up her bag from Frida's room and went downstairs. With his hand on the front door, Werner said, I'm so glad we're friends again.
Me too.
Do you think we'll be able to forget this period of estrangement? She did not know what he was trying to say. Did he want to be her lover again? Or was he telling her that was out of the question?
I think we can put it behind us,
she said neutrally.
Good.
He bent and kissed her lips very quickly. Then he opened the door. They left the house together, and he climbed on his motorcycle. Carlo walked down the driveway to the street and headed for the station. A moment later, Werner drove past her with a honk and a wave. Now that she was alone, she could begin to think about his revelation. How did she feel? For 2 years she had hated him, but in that time she had not had a serious boyfriend. Had she remained in love with him all along?
At a minimum, she had retained, in her heart of hearts, a fondness for him despite everything. Today, when she heard him in such distress, her hostility had melted away. Now she felt a glow of affection. Did she love him still? She did not know. 4. Marka sat in the rear seat of the black Mercedes with Werner beside him. Around Marka's neck was a bag, like a school satchel, except that he wore it in front instead of behind. It was small enough to be covered by a buttoned overcoat. A thin wire ran from the bag to a small earphone.
"It's the latest thing," Marka said. "As you get closer to the broadcaster, the sound gets louder."
Werner said, "More discreet than a van with a big aerial on its roof.
We have to use both, the van to discover the general area and this to pinpoint the exact location."
Marka was in trouble. Operation Citadel had been a catastrophe. Even before the offensive opened, the Red Army had attacked the airfields where the Luftwaffe were assembling. Citadel had been called off after a week, but even that was too late to prevent irreparable damage to the German army. Germany's leaders were always quick to blame Jewish Bolshevik conspirators whenever things went wrong, but in this case they were right. The Red Army had appeared to know the entire battle plan in advance, and that, according to Superintendent Kringelein, was Thomas Marker's fault. He was head of counter-espionage for the city of Berlin. His career was on the line. He faced dismissal and worse. His only hope now was a tremendous coup, a massive operation to round up the spies who were undermining the German war effort. So tonight, he had set a trap for Werner Frank. If Frank turned out to be innocent, he did not know what he would do. In the front seat of the car, a walkie-talkie crackled. Marker's pulse quickened. The driver picked up the handset.
"Wagner here."
He started the engine.
"We're on our way," he said. "Over and out."
It had started.
Marker asked him, "Where are we headed?"
"Kreuzberg."
It was a densely populated low-rent neighborhood south of the city center. As they pulled away, the air raid siren sounded. That was an unwelcome complication. Marker looked out of the window. The searchlights came on, waving like giant wands. Marka supposed they must have found planes sometimes, but he had never seen it happen. When the sirens ceased their howling, he could hear the thunder of approaching bombers. In the early years of the war, a British bombing mission had consisted of a few dozen aircraft, which was bad enough. But now they were sending hundreds at a time. The noise was terrifying even before they dropped their bombs. Werner said, "I suppose we'd better call off our mission tonight."
"Hell no," said Marka.
The roar of the planes grew. Flares and small incendiary bombs began to fall as the car approached Kreuzberg. The neighborhood was a typical target for the RAF's current strategy of killing as many civilian factory workers as possible. With staggering hypocrisy, Churchill and Attlee were claiming they attacked only military targets, and civilian casualties were a regrettable side effect. Berliners knew better. Wagner drove as fast as he could along streets, lit fitfully by flames. There were no people around apart from air raid officials. Everyone else was legally obliged to take shelter. The only other vehicles were ambulances, fire engines, and police cars. Marker covertly studied Werner. The boy was edgy, never quite still, staring out of the window anxiously, tapping his foot in unconscious tension. Marker had not confided his suspicions to anyone but his immediate team. It was going to be difficult for him if he had to admit that he had demonstrated Gestapo operations to someone whom he now thought was a spy. He could end up under interrogation in his own basement torture chamber. He was not going to do it until he was sure. The only way he might get away with it would be if, at the same time, he could present his superiors with a captured spy. But then, if his suspicion turned out to be true, he would arrest not just Werner, but his family and friends, and announce the destruction of a massive spy ring. That would transform the picture. He might even be promoted. As the raid progressed, the type of bombs changed, and Marker heard the profound thudding sound of high explosive. Once the target was illuminated, the RAF liked to drop a mixture of large oil bombs to start fires, and high explosive to ventilate the flames and hamper the emergency services. It was cruel, but Marka knew that the Luftwaffe's bombing pattern was similar. The sound in Marka's earphone started up as they drove cautiously along a street of five-story tenements. The area was taking a terrific pounding, and several buildings were newly demolished. Werner said shakily, "We're in the middle of the target area, for Christ's sake." Marka did not care. Tonight was already life or death to him.
"All the better," he said. "The pianist will imagine he doesn't need to worry about the Gestapo in the middle of an air raid."
Wagner stopped the car next to a burning church and pointed along a side street.
"Down there," he said.
Marka and Werner jumped out. Marka walked quickly along the street with Werner beside him and Wagner behind. Werner said,
"Are you sure it's a spy? Could it be anything else?"
"Broadcasting a radio signal?"
Marka said.
"What else could it be?"
Marka could still hear his earphone, but only just, for the air raid was cacophonous. The planes, the bombs, the anti-aircraft guns, the crash of falling buildings, and the roar of huge fires. They passed a stable where horses were neighing in terror, the signal growing ever stronger. Werner was glancing from side to side anxiously. If he was a spy, he would now be fearing that one of his colleagues was about to be arrested by the Gestapo, and wondering what the hell he could do about it. Would he repeat the trick he used last time, or think of some new way of giving a warning? If he was not a spy, this whole farce was a waste of time. Marka took out the earpiece and handed it to Werner.
"Listen," he said,
continuing to walk. Werner nodded. "Getting stronger," he said. The look in his eyes was almost frantic. He handed the earpiece back.
"I believe I've got you,"
Marka thought triumphantly. There was a thunderous crash as a bomb landed in a building they had just passed. They turned to see flames already licking up beyond the smashed windows of a bakery. Wagner said,
"Christ, that was close!"
They came to a school, a low brick building in an asphalt yard.
"In there, I think," said Marka.
The three men walked up a short flight of stone steps to the entrance. The door was not locked. They went in. They were at one end of a broad corridor. At its far end was a large door that probably led to the school hall.
"Straight ahead," said Marka.
He drew his gun, a 9mm Luger pistol. Werner was not armed. There was a crash, a thud, and the roar of an explosion, all terrifyingly close. All the windows in the corridor smashed, and shards of glass rained on the tiled floor. A bomb must have landed in the playground. Werner shouted,
"Clear out, everyone! The building is about to collapse!"
There was no danger of the building collapsing, Marka could see. This was Werner's ruse for giving the alarm to the pianist. Werner broke into a run, but instead of heading back the way they had come, he went on down the corridor toward the hall. To warn his friends, Marka thought. Wagner drew his gun, but Marka said,
"No, don't shoot!"
Werner reached the end of the corridor and flung open the door to the hall.
"Run, everyone!"
he yelled. Then he fell silent and stood still. Inside the hall, Marka's colleague, Mann, the electrical engineer, was tapping out nonsense on a suitcase radio. Beside him stood Schneider and Richter, both holding drawn guns. Marka smiled triumphantly. Werner had fallen right into his trap. Wagner walked forward and put his gun to Werner's head. Marka said,
"You're under arrest, you subhuman Bolshevik."
Werner acted fast. He jerked his head away from Wagner's gun, seized Wagner's arm, and pulled him into the hall. For a moment, Wagner shielded Werner from the guns in the hall. Then he thrust Wagner away from him, causing Wagner to stumble and fall. In the next moment, he stepped out of the hall and slammed the door. For a few seconds, it was just Marka and Werner in the corridor. Werner walked toward Marka. Marka pointed his Luger.
"Stop, or I'll shoot."
"No, you won't."
Werner came closer.
"You need to interrogate me and find out who the others are."
Marka pointed his gun at Werner's legs.
"I can interrogate you with a bullet in your knee," he said,
and he fired. The shot missed. Werner lunged and knocked Marka's gun hand aside. Marka dropped the weapon. As he stooped to retrieve it, Werner ran past. Marka picked up the gun. Werner reached the school door. Marka took careful aim at his legs and fired. His first three shots missed, and Werner went through the door. Marker fired one more shot through the still-open door, and Werner cried out and fell down. Marker ran along the corridor. Behind him, he heard the others coming out of the school hall. Then the roof opened with a crash. There was another noise like a thud, and liquid fire splashed like a fountain. Marker screamed in terror, then in agony, as his clothes caught alight. He fell to the ground. Then there was silence. Then darkness. 5. The doctors were triaging patients in the hospital lobby. Those merely bruised and cut were sent into the outpatients' waiting area, where the most junior nurses cleaned their cuts and consoled them with aspirins. The serious cases were given emergency treatment right there in the lobby, then sent to specialists upstairs. The dead were taken into the yard and laid on the cold ground until someone claimed them. Dr. Ernst examined a screaming burn victim and prescribed morphine. "Then get his clothes off and put some gel on those burns," he said, and moved on to the next one. Carla loaded a syringe while Frieda cut the patient's blackened clothes away. He had severe burns all down his right side, but the left was not so bad. Carla found an intact patch of skin and flesh on his left thigh. She was about to inject the patient when she looked at his face and froze. She knew that fat, round countenance with the mustache like a dirt mark under the nose. 2 years ago, he had come into the hall of her house and arrested her father. Next time she saw her father, he had been dying. This was Inspector Thomas Marker of the Gestapo. "You killed my father," she thought. "Now I can kill you." It would be simple. She would give him 4 times the maximum dose of morphine. No one would notice, especially on a night like tonight. He would fall unconscious immediately and die in a few minutes. A doctor, who was almost asleep on his feet, would assume his heart had failed. No one would doubt the diagnosis, and no one would ask skeptical questions. He would be one of thousands killed in a massive air raid. Rest in peace. She knew that Werner feared Marker might be onto him. Any day now, Werner could be arrested. Everyone talks under torture. Werner would give away Frieda and Heinrich and others, and Carla. She could save them all, now, in a minute. But she hesitated. She asked herself why. Marco was a torturer and a killer. He deserved to die 1,000 deaths. Carla had killed Joachim, or at least helped to kill him. But that had been a fight. Joachim had been kicking Carla's mother to death when she hit him over the head with a soup cauldron. This was different. Marco was a patient. Carla was not very religious, but she did believe that some things were sacred. She was a nurse, and patients put their trust in her. She knew that Marco would torture and kill her without hesitation, but she was not like Marco. She was not that kind. This was nothing to do with him. It was about her. If she killed a patient, she felt, she would have to leave the profession and never again dare to care for sick people. She would be like a banker who steals money, or a politician who takes bribes, or a priest who feels up the young girls who come to him for First Communion classes. She would have betrayed herself. Frieda said, "What are you waiting for? I can't gel him until he calms down." Carla stuck the needle in Thomas Marker, and he stopped screaming. Frieda started to put gel on his burned skin. "This one's only concussed," Dr. Ernst was saying of another patient, "but he's got a bullet in his backside." He raised his voice to talk to the patient. "How did you get shot? Bullets are about the only thing the RAF isn't throwing at us tonight." Carla turned to look. The patient was lying on his front. His trousers had been cut off, showing his rear. He had white skin and fine, fair hair on the small of his back. He was woozy, but he muttered something. Ernst said, "Policeman's gun went off by accident, did you say?" The patient spoke more clearly. "Yes. I'm going to take the bullet out. It will hurt, but we're short of morphine, and there are worse cases than you. Go ahead." Carla swabbed the wound. Ernst picked up a long, narrow pair of forceps. "Bite the pillow," he said. He inserted the forceps into the wound. A muffled cry of pain came from the patient. Dr. Ernst said, Try not to tense your muscles. It makes it worse. Carla thought that was a stupid thing to say. No one could relax their muscles while a wound was being probed. The patient roared.
Ah, shit!
I've got it, Dr. Ernst said. Try to keep still. The patient lay still, and Ernst drew the slug out and dropped it into a tray. Carla wiped the blood from the hole and slapped a dressing on the wound. The patient rolled over.
No,
Carla said. You must lie on your... She stopped. The patient was Werner.
Carla?
He said.
It's me,
she said happily, putting a bandage on your bum.
I love you,
he said. She threw her arms around him in the most unprofessional way possible and said,
Oh, my dearest, I love you too.
6. Thomas Marker came around slowly. At first he was in a dreamlike state. Then he became more aware and realized he was in a hospital and drugged. He knew why, too. His skin hurt intensely, especially down his left side. He was able to figure out that the drugs must be reducing the pain, but not completely eliminating it. Slowly he remembered how he had come here. He had been bombed. He would be dead if he had not been running away from the blast, chasing a fugitive. Those behind him were certainly dead, Mann, Schneider, Richter, and young Wagner, his whole team. But he had caught Werner. Or had he? He had shot Werner, and Werner had fallen. Then the bomb had dropped. Marker had survived, so Werner might have too. Marker was now the only man living who knew that Werner was a spy. He had to speak to his boss, Superintendent Kringelein. He tried to sit upright, but found he did not have the strength to move. He decided to call a nurse, but when he opened his mouth, no sound came out. The effort exhausted him, and he went back to sleep. The next time he awoke, he sensed it was night. The place was quiet, no one moving. He opened his eyes to see a face hovering over him. It was Werner.
You're leaving here now?
Werner said. Marker tried to call for help, but found he could not speak.
You're going to a new place, Werner said. You won't be a torturer anymore. In fact, you'll be the one who gets tortured there.
Marker opened his mouth to scream. A pillow descended on his face. It was pressed firmly over his mouth and nose. He found he could not breathe. He tried to struggle, but there was no strength in his limbs. He tried to gasp for air, but there was no air. He started to panic. He managed to move his head from side to side, but the pillow was pressed down more firmly. At last he made a noise, but it was only a whimper in his throat. The universe became a disk of light that shrank slowly until it was a pinpoint. Then it went out. Chapter 17 1943, Part 3
Will you marry me?
Said Volodya Peshkov, and held his breath.
No,
said Zoya Vorotsintsev,
but thank you.
She was remarkably matter-of-fact about everything, but this was unusually brisk even for her. They were in bed at the lavish Hotel Moskva, and they had just made love. Zoya had come twice. Her preferred type of sex was cunnilingus. She liked to recline on a pile of pillows while he knelt worshipfully between her legs. He was a willing acolyte, and she returned the favor with enthusiasm. They had been a couple for more than a year, and everything seemed to be going wonderfully well. Her refusal baffled him. He said,
Do you love me?
Yes, I adore you. Thank you for loving me enough to propose marriage. That was a bit better.
So why won't you accept?
I don't want to bring children into a world at war, she said.
Okay, I can understand that.
Ask me again when we've won.
By then I may not want to marry you.
If that's how inconstant you are, it's a good thing I refused you today.
Sorry.
For a moment there I forgot that you don't understand teasing.
I have to pee.
She got off the bed and walked naked across the hotel room. Volodya could hardly believe he was allowed to see this. She had the body of a fashion model or a movie star. Her skin was milk white and her hair pale blonde. All of it. She sat on the toilet without closing the bathroom door, and he listened to her peeing. Her lack of modesty was a perpetual delight. He was supposed to be working. The Moscow intelligence community was thrown into disarray every time Allied leaders visited, and Volodya's normal routine had been disrupted again for the Foreign Ministers' Conference that had opened on October 18th. The visitors were the American Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, and the British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden. They had a harebrained scheme for a four-power pact, including China. Stalin thought it was all nonsense, and did not understand why they were wasting time on it. The American, Hull, was 72 years old and coughing blood. His doctor had come to Moscow with him. But he was no less forceful for that, and he was insistent on the pact. There was so much to do during the conference that the NKVD, the secret police, were forced to cooperate with their hated rivals in Red Army Intelligence, Volodya's outfit. Microphones had to be concealed in hotel rooms. There was one in here, only Volodya had disconnected it. The visiting ministers and all their aides had to be kept under minute-by-minute surveillance. Their luggage had to be clandestinely opened and searched. Their phone calls had to be tape-recorded and transcribed and translated into Russian, and read and summarized. Most of the people they met, including waiters and chambermaids, were NKVD agents, but anyone else they happened to speak to, in the hotel lobby or on the street, had to be checked out, perhaps arrested and imprisoned and interrogated under torture. It was a lot of work. Volodya was riding high. His spies in Berlin were producing remarkable intelligence. They had given him the battle plan for the Germans' main summer offensive, Zitadel, and the Red Army had inflicted a tremendous defeat. Zoya was happy, too. The Soviet Union had resumed nuclear research, and Zoya was part of the team trying to design a nuclear bomb. They were a long way behind the West, because of the delay caused by Stalin's skepticism, but in compensation they were getting invaluable help from communist spies in England and America, including Volodya's old school friend, Willy Frunze. She came back to bed. Volodya said, "When we first met, you didn't seem to like me much." "I didn't like men," she replied. "I still don't. Most of them are drunks and bullies and fools. It took me a while to figure out that you were different." "Thanks, I think," he said. "But are men really so bad?"
"Look around you," she said. "Look at our country."
He reached over her and turned on the bedside radio. Even though he had disconnected the listening device behind the headboard, you couldn't be too careful. When the radio had warmed up, a military band played a march. Satisfied that he could not be overheard, Volodya said, "You're thinking of Stalin and Beria, but they won't always be around."
"Do you know how my father died?"
she said.
"No, my parents never mentioned it." "There's a reason for that."
"Go on."
"According to my mother, there was an election at my father's factory for a deputy to attend the Moscow Soviet. A Menshevik candidate stood against the Bolshevik, and my father went to a meeting to hear him speak. He did not support the Menshevik, nor vote for him. But everyone who went to that meeting was sacked, and a few weeks later my father was arrested and taken to the Lubyanka."
She meant the NKVD headquarters and prison in Lubyanka Square. She went on,
"My mother went to your father and begged him to help. He immediately went with her to the Lubyanka, but they were too late. My father was shot."
"That's terrible," Volodya said.
"But it was Stalin."
"No,
this was 1920. Stalin was just a Red Army commander fighting in the Soviet-Polish War. Lenin was leader."
"This happened under Lenin?"
"Yes, so you see. It's not just Stalin and Beria."
Volodya's view of communist history was badly shaken.
"What is it, then?"
The door opened. Volodya reached for his gun in the bedside table drawer. But the person who came in was a girl wearing a fur coat, and, as far as he could see, nothing else.
"Sorry, Volodya," she said. "I didn't know you had company."
Zoya said, "Who the fuck is she?" Volodya said,
"Natasha, how did you open my door?" "You gave me a passkey. It opens every door in the hotel."
"Well, you might have knocked."
"Sorry. I just came to tell you the bad news."
"What?"
"I went into Woody Duar's room, just as you told me. But I didn't succeed."
"What did you do?"
"This."
Natasha opened her coat to show her naked body. She had a voluptuous figure and a luxuriant bush of dark pubic hair.
All right, I get the picture. Close your coat, said Volodya. What did he say?
She switched to English.
He just said, no.
I said, what do you mean no?
He said, it's the opposite of yes.
Then he just held the door wide open until I went out.
Bugger, said Volodya. I have to think of something else.
2. Chuck Doer knew there was going to be trouble when Captain Vandermeer came into the enemy land section in the middle of the afternoon, red-faced from a beery lunch. The intelligence unit at Pearl Harbor had expanded, formerly called Station HYPO. It now had the grand title of Joint Intelligence Center, Pacific Ocean Area, or JICPOA. Vandermeer had a Marine sergeant in tow.
Hey, you two powder puffs, Vandermeer said. You got a customer complaint here.
As the operation had grown, everyone began to specialize, and Chuck and Eddie had become experts at mapping the territory where American forces were about to land as they fought their way island by island across the Pacific. Vandermeer said,
This is Sergeant Donegan.
The Marine was very tall and looked as hard as a rifle. Chuck guessed that the sexually troubled Vandermeer was smitten. Chuck stood up. Good to meet you, Sergeant. I'm Chief Petty Officer Dewar. Chuck and Eddie had both been promoted. As thousands of conscripts poured into the U.S. military, there was a shortage of officers, and pre-war enlisted men who knew the ropes rose fast. Chuck and Eddie were now permitted to live off base. They had rented a small apartment together. Chuck put out his hand, but Donegan did not shake it. Chuck sat down again. He slightly outranked a sergeant, and he was not going to be polite to one who was rude.
Something I can do for you, Captain Vandermeer?
There were many ways a captain could torment petty officers in the Navy, and Vandermeer knew them all. He adjusted rotas so that Chuck and Eddie never had the same day off. He marked their reports adequate, knowing full well that anything less than excellent was in fact a black mark. He sent confusing messages to the pay office, so that Chuck and Eddie were paid late or got less than they should have, and had to spend hours straightening things out. He was a royal pain, and now he had thought up some new mischief. Donegan pulled from his pocket a grubby sheet of paper and unfolded it.
Is this your work?
He said aggressively. Chuck took the paper. It was a map of New Georgia, a group in the Solomon Islands. Let me check, he said. It was his work, and he knew it, but he was playing for time. He went to a filing cabinet and pulled open a drawer. He took out the file for New Georgia and shut the drawer with his knee. He returned to his desk, sat down, and opened the file. It contained a duplicate of Donegan's map.
Yes, Chuck said. That's my work.
Well, I'm here to tell you it's shit, said Donegan.
Is it?
Look, right here. You show the jungle coming down to the sea. In fact, there's a beach a quarter of a mile wide.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Sorry?
Donegan had drunk about the same amount of beer as Vandermeer, and he was spoiling for a fight.
50 of my men died on that beach.
Vandermeer belched and said,
How could you make a mistake like that, Dewar?
Chuck was shaken. If he was responsible for an error that had killed 50 men, he deserved to be shouted at. This is what we had to work on, he said. The file contained an inaccurate map of the islands that might have been Victorian, and a more recent naval chart that showed sea depths, but almost no terrain features. There were no on-the-spot reports, and no wireless decrypts. The only other item in the file was a blurred black-and-white aerial reconnaissance photograph. Putting his finger on the relevant spot in the photo, Chuck said,
It sure looks as if the trees come all the way to the waterline. Is there a tide?
If not, the sand might have been covered with algae when the photograph was taken. Algae can bloom suddenly and die off just as fast.
Donegan said, You wouldn't be so goddamn casual about it if you had to fight over the terrain.
Maybe that was true, Chuck thought. Donegan was aggressive and rude, and he was being egged on by the malicious Vandermeer, but that did not mean he was wrong.
Vandermeer said, Yeah, Dewar. Maybe you and your Nancy boy friend should go with the Marines on their next assault. See how your maps are used in action.
Chuck was trying to think of a smart retort when it occurred to him to take the suggestion seriously. Maybe he ought to see some action. It was easy to be blasé behind a desk. Donegan's complaint deserved to be taken seriously. On the other hand, it would mean risking his life. Chuck looked Vandermeer in the eye.
That sounds like a good idea, Captain, he said. I'd like to volunteer for that duty.
Donegan looked startled, as if he was beginning to think he might have misjudged the situation. Eddie spoke for the first time.
So would I. I'll go too.
Good, said Vandermeer. You'll come back wiser. Or not at all.
3. Volodya could not get Woody Doer drunk. In the bar of the Hotel Moskva, he thrust a glass of vodka in front of the young American and said in schoolboy English,
You'll like this. It's the very best.
Thank you very much, said Woody. I appreciate it.
And he left the glass untouched. Woody was tall and gangly and seemed straightforward to the point of naivety, which was why Volodya had targeted him. Speaking through the interpreter, Woody said,
Is Peshkov a common Russian name?
Not especially, Volodya replied in Russian.
I'm from Buffalo, where there is a well-known businessman called Lev Peshkov. I wondered if you were related.
Volodya was startled. His father's brother was called Lev Peshkov and had gone to Buffalo before the First World War. But caution made him prevaricate.
I must ask my father, he said.
I was at Harvard with Lev Peshkov's son, Greg. He could be your cousin.
Possibly.
Volodya glanced nervously at the police spies around the table. Woody did not understand that any connection with someone in America could bring down suspicion on a Soviet citizen.
You know, Woody, in this country it's considered an insult to refuse to drink.
Woody smiled pleasantly.
Not in America, he said.
Volodya picked up his own glass and looked around the table at the assorted secret policemen pretending to be civil servants and diplomats.
A toast, he said, to friendship between the United States and the Soviet Union.
The others raised their glasses high. Woody did the same.
Friendship, they all echoed.
Everyone drank except Woody, who put his glass down untasted. Volodya began to suspect that he was not as naive as he seemed. Woody leaned across the table.
Volodya, you need to understand that I don't know any secrets. I'm too junior.
So am I, said Volodya.
It was far from the truth.
Woody said, What I'm trying to explain is that you can just ask me questions. If I know the answers, I'll tell you. I can do that, because anything I know can't possibly be secret. So you don't need to get me drunk or send prostitutes to my room. You can just ask me.
It was some kind of trick, Volodya decided. No one could be so innocent. But he decided to humor Woody.
Why not?
All right, he said. I need to know what you're after. Not you personally, of course. Your delegation and Secretary Hull and President Roosevelt. What do you want from this conference?
We want you to back the four-power pact.
It was the standard answer, but Volodya decided to persist.
This is what we don't understand.
He was being candid now, perhaps more than he should have, but instinct was telling him to take the risk of opening up a little.
Who cares about the pact with China? We need to defeat the Nazis in Europe. We want you to help us do that.
And we will.
So you say. But you said you would invade Europe this summer.
Well, we did invade Italy.
It's not enough.
France next year. We've promised that.
So why do you need the pact?
Well?
Woody paused, collecting his thoughts. We have to show the American people how it's in their interests to invade Europe.
Why?
Why what?
Why do you need to explain this to the public?
Roosevelt is president, isn't he?
He should just do it.
Next year is election year. He wants to get re-elected.
So?
American people won't vote for him if they think he's involved them unnecessarily in the war in Europe. So he wants to put it to them as part of his overall plan for world peace. If we have the four-power pact, showing that we're serious about the United Nations organization, then American voters are more likely to accept that the invasion of France is a step on the road to a more peaceful world.
This is amazing, Volodya said.
He's the president, yet he has to make excuses all the time for what he does.
Something like that, Woody said. We call it democracy. Volodya had a sneaking suspicion that this incredible story might actually be the truth.
So the pact is necessary to persuade American voters to support the invasion of Europe.
Exactly.
Then why do we need China?
Stalin was particularly scornful of the Allies' insistence that China should be included in the pact. China is a weak ally. So ignore China. If the Chinese are left out, they will become discouraged, and may fight less enthusiastically against the Japanese.
So?
So we will have to bolster our forces in the Pacific theater, and that will take away from our strength in Europe. That alarmed Volodya. The Soviet Union did not want Allied forces diverted from Europe to the Pacific.
So you are making a friendly gesture to China simply in order to conserve more forces for the invasion of Europe?
Yes. You make it seem simple.
It is, said Woody.
4. In the early hours of the morning on November 1st, Chuck and Eddie ate a steak breakfast with the U.S. Marine 3rd Division just off the South Sea Island of Bougainville. The island was about 125 miles long. It had two Japanese naval air bases, one in the north and one in the south. The Marines were getting ready to land halfway along the lightly defended west coast. Their object was to establish a beachhead and win enough territory to build an airstrip from which to launch attacks on the Japanese bases. Chuck was on deck at 7:26 when Marines in helmets and backpacks began to swarm down the rope nets hanging over the sides of the ship and jump into high-sided landing craft. With them were a small number of war dogs, Doberman pinschers that made tireless sentries. As the boats approached land, Chuck could already see a flaw in the map he had prepared. Tall waves crashed onto a steeply sloping beach. As he watched, a boat turned sideways to the waves and capsized. The Marines swam for shore.
We have to show surf conditions, Chuck said to Eddie, who was standing beside him on the deck. How do we find them out?
Reconnaissance aircraft will have to fly low enough for white caps to register on their photographs.
They can't risk coming that low when there are enemy air bases so close.
Eddie was right, but there had to be a solution. Chuck filed it away as the first question to be considered as a result of this mission. For this landing, they had benefited from more information than usual. As well as the normal unreliable maps and hard-to-decipher aerial photographs, they had a report from a reconnaissance team landed by submarine 6 weeks earlier. The team had identified 12 beaches suitable for landing along a 4-mile stretch of coast, but they had not warned of the surf. Perhaps it was not so high that day. In other respects, Chuck's map was right so far. There was a sandy beach about 100 yards wide, then a tangle of palm trees and other vegetation. Just beyond the brush line, according to the map, there should be a swamp. The coast was not completely undefended. Chuck heard the roar of artillery fire, and a shell landed in the shallows. It did no harm, but the gunner's aim would improve. The Marines were galvanized with a new urgency as they leaped from the landing craft to the beach and ran for the brush line. Chuck was glad he had decided to come. He had never been careless or slack about his maps, but it was salutary to see firsthand how correct mapping could save men's lives, and how the smallest errors could be deadly. Even before they embarked, he and Eddie had become a lot more demanding. They asked for blurred photographs to be taken again. They interrogated reconnaissance parties by phone, and they cabled all over the world for better charts. He was glad for another reason. He was at sea, which he loved. He was on a ship with 700 young men, and he relished the camaraderie, the jokes, the songs, and the intimacy of crowded berths and shared showers. It's like being a straight guy in a girl's boarding school, he said to Eddie one evening. Except that that never happens, and this does, Eddie said. He felt the same as Chuck. They loved each other, but they did not mind looking at naked sailors. Now all 700 Marines were getting off the ship and onto land as fast as they could. The same was happening at 8 other locations along this stretch of coast. As soon as a landing craft emptied out, it lost no time in turning around and coming back for more, but the process still seemed desperately slow. The Japanese artillery gunner, hidden somewhere in the jungle, found his range at last, and to Chuck's shock, a well-aimed shell exploded in a knot of Marines, sending men and rifles and body parts flying through the air to litter the beach and stain the sand red. Chuck was staring in horror at the carnage when he heard the roar of a plane and looked up to see a Japanese Zero flying low, following the coast. The red suns painted on the wings struck fear into his heart. Last time he saw that sight had been at the Battle of Midway. The Zero strafed the beach. Marines who were in the process of disembarking from landing craft were caught defenseless. Some threw themselves flat in the shallows. Some tried to get behind the hull of the boat. Some ran for the jungle. For a few seconds blood spurted and men fell. Then the plane was gone, leaving the beach scattered with American dead. Chuck heard it open up a moment later, strafing the next beach. It would be back. There were supposed to be U.S. planes in attendance, but he could not see any. Air support was never where you wanted it to be, which was directly above your head. When all the Marines were ashore, alive and dead, the boats transported medics and stretcher parties to the beach. Then they began landing supplies, ammunition, drinking water, food, drugs, and dressings. On the return trip, the landing craft brought the wounded back to the ship. Chuck and Eddie, as non-essential personnel, went ashore with the supplies. The boat skippers had got used to the swell now, and their craft held a stable position, with its ramp on the sand and the waves breaking on its stern, while the boxes were unloaded and Chuck and Eddie jumped into the surf to wade to shore. They reached the waterline together. As they did so, a machine gun opened up. It seemed to be in the jungle about 400 yards along the beach. Had it been there all along, the gunner biding his time, or had it just been moved into position from another location? Eddie and Chuck bent double and ran for the tree line. A sailor with a crate of ammunition on his shoulder gave a shout of pain and fell, dropping the box. Then Eddie cried out. Chuck ran on 2 paces before he could stop. When he turned, Eddie was rolling on the sand, clutching his knee, yelling, "Ah, fuck!" Chuck came back and knelt beside him. "It's okay. I'm here," he shouted. Eddie's eyes were closed, but he was alive, and Chuck could see no wounds other than the knee. He glanced up. The boat that had brought them was still close to shore, being unloaded. He could get Eddie back to the ship in minutes, but the machine gun was still firing. He got into a crouching position. "This is going to hurt," he said. "Yell as much as you like." He got his right arm under Eddie's shoulder, then slid his left under Eddie's thighs. He took the weight and straightened up. Eddie screamed with pain as his smashed leg swung free. "Hang in there, buddy," Chuck said. He turned toward the water. He felt sudden, unbearably sharp pains in his legs, his back, and finally his head. In the next fraction of a second, he thought he must not drop Eddie. A moment later, he knew he was going to. There was a flash of light behind his eyes that rendered him blind, and then the world came to an end. 5. On her day off, Carla worked at the Jewish hospital. Dr. Rothman had persuaded her. He had been released from the camp. No one knew why, except the Nazis, and they did not tell anyone. He had lost one eye and he walked with a limp, but he was alive and capable of practicing medicine. The hospital was in the northern working-class district of Wedding, but there was nothing proletarian about the architecture. It had been built before the First World War, when Berlin's Jews had been prosperous and proud. There were 7 elegant buildings set in a large garden. The different departments were linked by tunnels, so that patients and staff could move from one to another without braving the weather. It was a miracle there was still a Jewish hospital. Very few Jews were left in Berlin. They had been rounded up in their thousands and sent away in special trains. No one knew where they had gone or what happened to them. There were incredible rumors about extermination camps. The few Jews still in Berlin could not be treated, if they were sick, by Aryan doctors and nurses. So, by the tangled logic of Nazi racism, the hospital was allowed to remain. It was mainly staffed by Jews and other unfortunate people who did not count as properly Aryan, Slavs from Eastern Europe, people of mixed ancestry, and those married to Jews. But there were not enough nurses, so Carla helped out. The hospital was harassed constantly by the Gestapo, critically short of supplies, especially drugs, understaffed, and almost completely without funds. Carla was breaking the law as she took the temperature of an 11-year-old boy whose foot had been crushed in an air raid. It was also a crime for her to smuggle medicines out of her everyday hospital and bring them here. But she wanted to prove, if only to herself,
that not everyone had given in to the Nazis. As she finished her ward round, she saw Werner outside the door, in his Air Force uniform. For several days he and Carla had lived in fear, wondering whether anyone had survived the bombing of the school and lived to condemn Werner. But it was now clear they had all died, and no one else knew of Marker's suspicions. They had got away with it again. Werner had recovered quickly from his bullet wound, and they were lovers. Werner had moved into the von Ulrichs' large, half-empty house, and he slept with Carla every night. Their parents made no objection. Everyone felt they could die any day, and people should take what joy they could from a life of hardship and suffering. But Werner looked more solemn than usual as he waved to Carla through the glass panel in the door to the ward. She beckoned him inside and kissed him.
"I love you,"
she said. She never tired of saying it. He was always happy to say, "I love you too."
"What are you doing here?"
she said. "Did you just want a kiss? I've got bad news. I've been posted to the Eastern Front."
"Oh, no."
Tears came to her eyes. "It's really a miracle I've avoided it this long. But General Doran can't keep me any longer. Half our army consists of old men and schoolboys, and I'm a fit 24-year-old officer." She whispered,
"Please don't die.
I'll do my best." Still whispering, she said, "But what will happen to the network? You know everything. Who else could run it?" He looked at her without speaking. She realized what was in his mind.
"Oh, no. Not me.
You're the best person. Frieda's a follower, not a leader. You've shown the ability to recruit new people and motivate them. You've never been in trouble with the police, and you have no record of political activity. No one knows the role you played in opposing Action T4. As far as the authorities are concerned, you are a blameless nurse.
But Werner, I'm scared."
"You don't have to do it. But no one else can." Just then they heard a commotion. The neighboring ward was for mental patients, and it was not unusual to hear shouting and even screaming. But this seemed different. A cultured voice was raised in anger. Then they heard a second voice. This one with a Berlin accent and the insistent bullying tone that outsiders said was typical of Berliners. Carla stepped into the corridor, and Werner followed. Dr. Rothman, wearing a yellow star on his jacket, was arguing with a man in SS uniform. Behind them, the double doors to the psychiatric ward, normally locked, were wide open. The patients were leaving. Two more policemen and a couple of nurses were herding a ragged line of men and women, most in pajamas, some walking upright and apparently normal, others shambling and mumbling as they followed one another down the staircase. Carla was immediately reminded of Ada's son, Kurt, and Werner's brother, Axel, and the so-called hospital in Ackelberg. She did not know where the patients were going, but she was quite sure they would be killed there. Dr. Rothman was saying indignantly, "These people are sick. They need treatment." The SS officer replied, "They're not sick. They're lunatics, and we're taking them where lunatics belong. To a hospital? You will be informed in due course. That's not good enough." Carla knew she should not intervene. If they found out she was not Jewish, she would be in deep trouble. She did not look particularly Aryan or otherwise, with dark hair and green eyes. If she kept quiet, probably they would not bother her. But if she protested about what the SS were doing, she would be arrested and questioned, and then it would come out that she was working illegally. So she clamped her teeth together. The officer raised his voice. "Hurry up! Get those cretins in the bus!" Rothman persisted. "I must be informed where they are going. They are my patients." They were not really his patients. He was not a psychiatrist. The SS man said, "If you're so concerned about them, you can go with him." Dr. Rothman paled. He would almost certainly be going to his death. Carla thought of his wife, Anna Laura, his son Rudy, and his daughter in England, Ava, and she felt sick with fear. The officer grinned. "Suddenly not so concerned?" he jeered. Rothman straightened up. "On the contrary," he said, "I accept your offer. I swore an oath many years ago to do all I can to help sick people. I'm not going to break my oath now. I hope to die at peace with my conscience." He limped down the stairs.
An old woman went by wearing nothing but a robe open at the front, showing her nakedness. Carla could not remain silent.
It's November out